Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Verse 124, chapter 7. Kavya-taraka-dikeshu-cha Vikshipyate-pravrityadhihi Vishikyate-pravrityadhihi Taistat-dvasmitya-sampavad Taistat-dvasmitya-sampavad Krishi Vanijya Seva Adel Kavya Taraka Adikeshu Cha Vikshipyate Pravritya Dhihi Taihi Tatva Smriti Asampavat. Let me just review quickly the context before you remember what we're doing. What does it take to get jnana-nishtha? It means to have the mind that is really rooted in this knowledge without any obstruction. So if you look at the Vedanta sadhana, shravana manana nididhyasana, they've gone through this kind of meticulous framework. We've looked at shravana as being the means for understanding exactly the vision the shastra has to give you. Without doubt, seeing clearly what the Shastra says. What is the vision of the Upanishads? So through Shravana, you gain this Upanishadic vision. Through Manana, you're able to answer any doubts that are outside of the Upanishad. In other words, with Shravana, you'll answer all of the doubts that are Does the Upanishad really say this, or does it say that? What is the Upanishad actually saying? What is the tat paraya? What is the essential vision of the Upanishad? Do all the Upanishads say the same thing? And what is it that they say? That becomes clear through Shravana. Manana deals with all of the doubts that are really outside of the purview of the Upanishads. Like, for instance, what does the Sankhya say? What do the Buddhists say? What do the Charvakas say? What do you say? What doubts do you have? Like, for instance, if the Upanishads were to say they reveal the identity of yourself with Brahman, but the non-dual reality of this creation, your mind might say, well, that's what the Upanishads say, but why can't it be like this? You know? Why can't it be like this? Why can't I actually just be this physical body, and consciousness is something that is produced by the brain? Consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain. Why can't it be like that? The Upanishads are not saying that it's that, right? But that's a doubt that you have, and a doubt that a lot of different philosophical schools will have also. So manana is meant to resolve these type of doubts through the use of logic. It's really through the use of logic as applied to the particular doubt that you have. When a person is bringing a doubt to you that is outside of kind of the Upanishadic vision, then through logic and experience and the understanding of the what we call epistemological limits of the pramanas, of the means of knowledge, you can show how that particular notion that the person has, or ideology that the person has, is false. So the first thing that you do in manana is not to establish the Upanishadic vision, but is to negate the vision, the vision that the person brings to you if it's not true. Because if you don't negate that, the vision that the person brings to you, then what you're doing is superimposing the vision of the Upanishads upon that false vision. There's nothing to remove it. So you have to remove that. Manana removes these false concepts through the use of logic and your own experience. Everybody see the difference? It's a big difference, really. So sometimes manana is kind of included with the shravana, even using manana and logic to establish what the Upanishads say. But the Upanishads themselves establish their vision. So if we kind of, we can parse it like that, where manana is just really used to negate the notions that won't hold up to scrutiny. That's what manana is for. The whole Brahma Sutras, the first chapter of the Brahma Sutras, is dealing with shravana. It's establishing the vision of the Upanishads. The second chapter is bringing in all the other schools of thought that were happening at that time that don't have the same Upanishadic vision that the Advaita Vedanta has, and they'll take those schools one at a time and argue with them. It's called Purvapaksha Siddhanta, in order to negate the validity of their positions. Because if their position's not saying something opposite to what the Upanishad is saying, both aren't going to be true. And that's something that, and I often kind of joke, in the West, people don't like that. They like everything to be true. But sometimes, you know, it's either one self or many selves. Is the physical creation Prakriti? Is it real material or is it mitya? It's either real material or it's mitya. It's not both. It's either one self or many selves. It's not both. Right? And so say you say, no, all paths lead to the same goal. We can say all spiritual paths lead to Antakarana Shuddhi, and there are many different spiritual paths that lead to that many different means that lead to Antakarana Shuddhi, purity of mind. But there aren't many different knowledges. There's only one knowledge. In this sense, by the very definition of knowledge, what jnanam actually is, what makes jnanam, what makes knowledge knowledge, or jnanam as a cognition, we can be technically call that prama. What makes something prama, an actual knowledge, is that it is true to the vastu. The vastu means the reality. What makes something knowledge is that it's true, you know, to the vastu. Otherwise, it's mithya jnanam. It's false knowledge. It's not true. It's not true to the vastu. It's not true to the reality. But that's not knowledge. Right? And say your liberation is dependent upon knowledge. So the whole premise of the Upanishad, moksha is jnanam. Moksha is self-knowledge. It's not that you gain self-knowledge and then do something to become liberated. Moksha is self-knowledge. Because in order for yourself to be free, or to be limitless, or to be changeless, or to be free from birth and death, which is how moksha is defined, that which is whole, that which is complete, that which is free from suffering, that which is free from birth and death, that self already has to be that way. If it's not that way, it's bound by change. It exists something already existing within the creation, within the time-space creation. And by its very nature, like the rest of the creation, everything that exists in the creation, is bound by time, bound by change. And so if you are also part of this creation, as an object within this creation, then you also are bound by time, bound by change, bound by birth and death, as is this body, as are your sense organs, as is your mind, as are your emotions, as even the changing ahankara. As is every part of everything that makes you a jiva, the everything that we call an upadi, all of that is existing within the creation and is bound by change, exists within time and space, bound by duality. So now, what can you do about that? Can you free yourself of that if you are that? If you are this physical body, is knowledge going to help you free yourself from death? If you're the body, can you be free from death? I would say no. Can knowledge free you from death? No. In fact, is there anything that can? Is there any type of action that can free you from death? Maybe you can put it off for a while, that's all. The mind by nature is a changing entity. Is there anything that you can do to make the mind changeless or free from modification? Free from duality? Free from the opposites? Say, no, that's the very swarupa of the mind. It's the very nature of the mind. And so the knowledge is not going to, free you. It'll just give you the facts about what the mind is. Yeah, the mind is not free. The body is not free. That's the reality. Moksha, now if we say moksha, liberation, is knowledge, then that means that the self that you are is already free. And what is stopping you from being free has nothing to do with activity. It has only to do with ignorance, non-recognition of your own self, of your own being. That's the only way knowledge can set you free. It can remove the ignorance that is causing a misconception. If, in fact, you are bound, neither knowledge nor action, activity, can set you free. And so say, knowledge. Say the Atma is already free, then what is stopping you from being free is your lack of knowledge of who you are. That means that you, which is our situation. We take ourselves to be this body, mind, sense organs. If I have an identity with the body, mind, sense organs, then I'm subject to birth and death and limitation because that's the nature of the thing that I've identified with. And so now, that being so, the ajnanam has to be removed. In order for me to be liberated, the ajnanam, the ignorance, has to be removed. How to remove that ignorance? Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. For the mumukshu, for the one who desires liberation, who has become a jignyasa, who really recognizes this problem, then the Upanishads become a pramana, a means of knowledge for removing this ajnanam, which is the cause of the bondage. And so now, that's why understanding exactly how this knowledge takes place and what is the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, what is the shravana do? What does the manana do? What does the nididhyasana do? If the Upanishad is working as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, then the wielding of the pramana, the wielding of the Upanishad by the teacher, according to Sampradaya, is meant to make the student see. It's to see the vision that that is held in the Upanishads. That's the teaching methodology. Okay. The manana is meant to remove from the student any doubts about the truth of that, of what you see. Because couldn't it be like this or couldn't it be like that? And then, nididhyasana, contemplation, is meant to remove the viparita bhavana, that habitual identification because of lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes of identification with this body. The vision takes place, you see it, you understand the truth of it, and your mind keeps behaving like, as though you're a jiva, as though you're samsari, just because of habit. So viparita bhavana is what we've been working on here. Now we're moving, we're taking a little bit of movement from this viparita bhavana. Viparita bhavana means that sense of being what I'm not. Viparita means an erroneous conclusion. So viparita bhavana, in reference to self-knowledge, is my identification with the body, my identification with the sense organs, my identification with the upadi, in terms of that, where the Atma is identified with the body, mind, sense organs, and the world is real. Jagat Satyam. Right? Jagat Satyam means this world is real. And this body, mind, sense organs is me. Right? Soon as I take myself to be this body, mind, sense organs, then I am real, so this is real. So what do I have to recognize? Is that myself, the Atma, is actually free of the body, mind, sense organs, and if the body, mind, sense organs belongs to the jagat, belongs to the world, belongs to Ishvara, and the Atma, the self that I am, is the self of the whole. That's what I have to see. So now, when we're working on this vipadita bhavana, what is the way to remove that? Because we have lifetimes of misidentification, which is just natural. It's not like you created the ignorance, you're a product of ignorance. It's not like there's a prior condition, oh, I did have knowledge, you know, many lifetimes ago, and then I lost it. No. When I was born, I had knowledge, but then I was, no. We're all a manifestation of ajnanam. To really understand that, just a little aside on this. If you have a lucid dream, right, or an imagination, you're the Ishvara of that imagination. For you, there's just this wonderful Maya Upadhi that is able to express as a universe that is so powerful. It can just with such ease express as a universe your imagination. And for you, you are the self of that whole. You're not affected by the whole. The imagination comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back into you, nothing happens to you, you're the very being of the whole thing. It's mitya. It's not real, I am real. It's mitya. It depends on me only for its reality. And that is not a problem for me, that is self-evident for me as the Ishvara, as the Lord of that imagination. It is self-evident, right? Can everybody see that? If you have an imagination, it's self-evident. That imagination is mitya. It depends on you. You are the self. You are not changing. All kinds of horrible things can happen in the imagination. People can be born and die. All kinds of things. You know? But nothing happens to you. You're pervasive to the whole, and you're the stable satyam. You're the truth of it. You're the changeless truth of it. So as Ishvara, this is my Maya Upadhi. There's no ajnanam for me. There's only vikshepa, and here vikshepa is used in the sense of the Maya Upadhi projects. That's how we use the vikshepa. I have that Maya Upadhi, which is natural to me, the conscious being, and that Upadhi, that Maya, projects and resolves. That's what we call vikshepa. And that's Ishvara's position, situation. But now think of it like this. You have a lucid dream or an imagination, and in the imagination there's a lot of characters. Those characters are part and parcel of the imagination. They're not made of anything else. They have the same me, the same satyam as their reality, the same one self is the truth of the whole, the truth that the thing is the truth of the entire projection is the truth of every part of it. But each individual is limited, right? Each is limited by a limited body, limited sense organs, limited mind, limited time, limited space, right? It's existing within the imagination, looking around. That is its reality. This world is real, and I'm a real being in the world, and I'm experiencing the world through my sense organs and my mind. And my mind is limited. It's not all pervasive. The mind isn't just for Ishvara. This entire creation is jnanam. It's manifest knowledge. Just like if you have an imagination, we say that's jnanam. It's manifest knowledge. Like coming into, it's knowledge coming into manifestation. And the whole thing is known. Like a giant vritti, like a giant mind. The whole thing is known. But all of the parts within that imagination, they are limited. Limited minds, limited sense organs, limited body. And so, what is just vikshepa, the manifestation of limitless knowledge for Ishvara, or for you in reference to your imagination, is not vikshepa. It's not just vikshepa. For the jiva, within the imagination, it's avadana. That maya, same maya upadhi, which is just vikshepa for Ishvara, just the projection for Ishvara, that maya becomes avarana, a covering, like a veil for the jiva. Because even though the jiva, the individual, is part and parcel of that whole creation, The pramanas, the means of knowledge that are available for the jiva, the mind and the sense organs, and located in this body, are all limited. They have limited knowledge. With no means of knowledge for that jiva, that individual, to know that, oh, I'm part and parcel of the whole and I'm really myself, it's limitless. And in fact, this is my whole projection from the standpoint of the self. No means of knowledge for that. So that's the plight of the jiva, and for the jiva, each one of us, it has always been that way. There's not a prior condition. See, think of it. See, in reference to your imagination, the jivas all come as part of the imagination. Say there's plants and animals and living beings and all kinds of things going on in the imagination. Those jivas in the imagination had no prior condition. They are a product, the upadis. The conditioning adjuncts are a product of that Maya Upadhi, and that product is limited. See what I mean? That reflects consciousness, all right, but that mind can only know that it is enjoying consciousness. So and the sense organs, they enjoy consciousness. My body, I enjoy consciousness. What does that mean? I am a conscious being. That is the adhyasa. That is the superimposition that identifies the self from whom the whole imagination has come with the individual being within the imagination. The individual being within the imagination makes that identification. I am the conscious being. But what is the truth? The truth is that the conscious being that I am is the self of the whole. There is no limitation to the conscious being. The whole imagination comes, is sustained, and goes back. What is left is the truth, is the satyam, is the conscious being. I am that conscious being. Now this, just see what a huge problem this is. This jiva within the creation needs to gain knowledge. Look at the knowledge that it has to gain. It has to realize, without any doubt, it has to see. And recognize the mind of that jiva has to see and recognize without any doubt, to actually see it, that this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of the whole. And the whole comes, this body, mind, sense organs is the warp and woof of that. It's part and parcel of it. And then it has to see it, but think of this, it has lifetimes in reference to Ishwara, in reference to the whole creation. It has lifetimes of just being a jiva, where this world is real and I'm a real entity here. And so it sees. So this is what happens. The Upanishad is there for the mumukshu, who says, hey, what is the truth of all of this? Is there anything about me that is real? What is the truth? What is the truth of me? So say when a person wants to know, then the Upanishad is there. Then there is a means of knowledge available that we call the Upanishad. That Upanishad has to then be wielded by a teacher who knows. And that teacher has to take the student through that teaching methodology so the student will also know. And then has to be able to remove all of the doubts of the student, because there's no problem from the standpoint of the self. From the standpoint of the self, I'm just the pure conscious being from which this whole thing has come. The doubts are from the jiva, from the mind, the sense organs, the one who's experiencing all of this as real. All of those questions, all of those doubts, all of those concerns, well, can it be like this, can it be like that, all of that has to be resolved for the mind of that seeker. Because it's the mind that takes itself to be bound. Now the mind has to recognize that, yeah, the mind is bound, the body is bound, but I'm not bound. The self is not bound. It has to see it. And then it needs to be able to own it. And that's where all of these verses are going to be dealing with now. How to own it, what not to do, what to do. When you're a seeker, when you're trying to gain nishta, when you're trying to get really a mind that abides there, that has clarity, what to do? How to get rid of the viparita bhavana, this erroneous conclusion that rises in spite of my knowledge. So how to handle that vipari kabhavana. So that's where we are, okay? And have been for some time. We've been on this for a while. So if you remember, in the last verse, in 123, he said, he was talking about things that you, how to occupy your time. Do you have to sit and do meditation in a particular way? Do you have to sit and contemplate in a particular way, you know, in order to do nididhyasana? Or can your mind be a little bit more free than that? Or can you do it wrong? Can you make some mistakes there? How to do it? Yeah. He says, there's not a wrong way really to do this. Because there's no adrishta, right? There's no, I'm just trying to bring this back to you from this last week. There's no adrishta pola involved here. Like if you were to do japa of a particular mantra, you can gain adrishta pola. You can gain papa from doing it incorrectly. It can be problematic for you. You have to do it properly. Like if you're doing a chant, you have to have the correct swaras. You have to have the correct pronunciation. You have to do it properly. If you're doing an upasana on an ishtadevata, say it's a particular upasana, you have to know how to do it, and you have to do it properly according to the steps and following the rules, so to speak. Do you have to do nididhyasana properly? He says, no. There's no rules.
Good.
Just like there's no rules for eating. If a person, remember these examples? If you're hungry, then you have to somehow get some food for yourself. And you have to eat it. But you can eat it with your hand, or you can eat it with chopsticks. You know, or you can use a knife and fork. You can sit at a table, or you can sit in a chair. Or you can walk around eating. It doesn't make any difference. It's up to you. And you can eat a little or more. It's up to you. And whatever you do, what you'll be doing is appeasing your hunger. And so what does this mean? That the result of eating, something as in this example he uses, gives an immediate result. Right? When you say you're suffering from hunger pangs, when you eat, you're not accruing adrishta, subtle results of your actions that will manifest later in time. When you're eating, you're satisfying the immediate need of assuaging your hunger. So it's what we call a drishtapola. In nididhyasana, why do you even do nididhyasana? Say you have knowledge and all is well. You are you. The Atma, the self that I am, the Atma that I am is Brahman. That's all fine. The world is mitya, that's fine. I'm not doing nididhyasana. I am the nididhyasana. See, I'm not doing it. At that time, I'm not doing any nididhyasana. Nididhyasana is natural to me. Because myself, who I am, is clear. I have clarity. The jagan mitya, the apparent nature of the creation, that's clear. So that nididhyasana is just a fact. I don't need to do nididhyasana. I'm going to do nididhyasana on top of nididhyasana. It doesn't make any sense. So when do I do nididhyasana? When do I do that type of contemplation? Is when my mind has got lost in the samsara. I've taken myself to be the body. I've taken my ananda to be out here. I've gotten myself entangled in all of the emotional mess that we can find ourselves entangled in the creation. And now I'm suffering, just like suffering from hunger, but now I have some sort of emotional suffering that's making me feel unhappy. Oops, time to do nididhyasana. Right? It's time to pull my mind back to who I am and what this creation is. Now, how am I going to do that? Well, there are countless ways to do that. It depends upon what the problem is and where you are and what it is that needs to be pulled back. You know, what is the problem? And so then you'll apply your knowledge, what you know, to that problem. That's the nididhyasana. You apply your knowledge to that problem. What does that mean? You bring your, in reference to that problem, or to that hurt, or to whatever it is that you're suffering from, even on the psychological, or in terms of your complexes, or in terms of just your day-to-day reality, difficult people, all of the messy things that can happen. You apply your knowledge to that situation, which means what? You just bring yourself back in reference to that given situation. That's nididhyasana. Your mind becomes habituated to being able to do that. So then the question is, okay, so how to kind of protect my mind as I'm gaining this knowledge? How to protect my mind until I gain this nishta and I don't have to worry about getting lost in samsara? How do I protect my mind? That's what he's in 123. He was talking about that. What he said was, in a positive way, there's things, you know, like the itihasas, you know, you can contemplate, you can study the shastra, you can do this katana, talking to each other, doing, having satsang, teaching each other, talking to each other, exposing yourself to the shastra, reading the itihasas, reading the Mahabharata, reading the Ramayana, reading these texts and Puranic texts, all of these texts, all of them, they have wonderful stories. Your mind can enjoy the stories, but all of them always resolve in this vision. They always resolve in Dharma and will take you to this vision. So that's something fun that you can do. Because all of it keeps you within that vision. Same with Natya, with all of the different, there's so many cultural things. This is all within an Indian context, right? There's so many cultural things that we continue to resolve in this vision, so you can enjoy those things. You know? And your mind doesn't have to be constrained, but it's a type of activity that keeps you in this teaching, keeps you in that recognition until you don't need to keep yourself in it. So it's just a support for the mind. But in this verse, he says like this. However, remember, this is India and probably the 12th century, I think. Okay. Or Vijayawada.
Yeah, that's right.
Say, okay. So what he says, what about this? He says, Krishi. Krishi means farming and agriculture, because it's an agricultural society. Farming, vanijya. Vanijya is getting involved in business and trade. Seva is all of the different types of service work that you can do. So in this agricultural work, in business transactions, in trade, in just general seva, government work, that type of thing, and all of these things. And then kavya, reading all of the poets. Kavya in India, the poetry is very, very... very complex Sanskrit, where the verses have to be worked on and untangled. They're brilliant, brilliant verses, but the poets would make sure to make them very difficult. You know, so you would have to really work on those verses to bring them to life. Long, intricate compounds like that. This kavya, tarka, logic. The nyayayikas, the logic. Logic also is like a vast, dense forest. Okay? You go in, you can't come out.
Don't go there.
you never get out, because it goes on and on and on and on. So what they say, don't, you know, he goes like this. Vikshipyate pravitya dihi. Your mind, the mind, by engaging in these things, vikshipyate, will get distracted. Because these things are distracting. Say you're trying to gain a nishta, you're trying to get this vision, you're learning it, you need some protection because you're starting out, and yet you spend all of your time doing these things which totally pull your mind away into these other complicated realms. That will involve, the first part is what that you get totally involved in business and the results of your business and making money and having growing your business and having all of the different interconnections and interrelationships, all of the networking that's involved making your business a success. So all of your energy is plowing into your business or into producing your produce and selling it and all this. So your mind gets totally sucked into the business. And so, of course, your mind is distracted, right? Because all of the your attention is on making the business successful. That's one end. Another end. You get into Kavya, which is a forest in of its own. It's another a study. It's another study. You get into Kavya. And then that takes all of your energy and all of your time, because Kavya is complex. So now you're in a different subject matter. So all of your mind is engaged in that. Or you get into Tarka, this world of logic. Now all of your mind is engaged in that. So of course you're distracted. Because now you're spending your time doing this and getting engaged in that, and all of the results that you're trying to achieve are other than gaining a nishta or understanding of this knowledge. And so you're spending a lot of time out there, so to speak. So of course your mind will get distracted. And tatva smriti asambhavat. And at that time, it's not capable, asambhava means not capable, because it's not capable of tatva smriti, of holding this knowledge. Right? It's not remembering this knowledge, it's not doing nitta dhyasana, it's totally engaged in the samsara. That's the idea. Later on, just in case you're getting confused, later on, a few verses from now, he'll say, you know, this isn't a problem for somebody who has knowledge, because there isn't anything that you're doing that can pull your mind away. But it can be a problem. It can be a problem for somebody who's trying to gain knowledge, because they're becoming a dilettante. So much energy here, so much energy here, so much emotional energy here, emotional energy there. So what he's saying is you need to be able to pull back from these commitments that are taking your mind and heart. And that's the idea. These commitments that are taking your mind and heart, you know, so that your mind is not available for that knowledge, that probably you don't want to do. Right? Until it's not a problem. Once it's not a problem, it's not a problem. But until it's a problem, then where is your focus? Okay, let me just do a little aside here. When they do talk about the sadhana chatushtaya, remember that? The fourfold sadhanas, for an adhikari, for one is qualified for this knowledge. Because we're talking here about a mumukshu, a person who's an adhikari. We don't viveka, vairagya. You have to have that ability to discriminate where you've got it. You've understood. Everything that I experience in this creation is subject to change, period. Including my body, mind, sense organs. Everything within the Maya is subject to change. And therefore, there's nothing lasting that I can gain from this. That means there any wholeness on my part, to the degree that it's dependent upon something in the world, to that degree that wholeness is very fragile. Any ananda that is dependent on something in the world is a very fragile ananda, because there's nothing in the world that isn't subject to change. So that's viveka. So then I recognize that, oh my God, everything here is subject to change. How can I gain anything lasting, any lasting shanti or any lasting peace from something in the world? As if the world would be responsible for giving it to me. I can't. So that leads to the vairagya. Vairagya is, okay, therefore these things in this creation can't solve this problem. They can't solve the problem of a lasting wholeness. I recognize that. That leads to the mumukshutvam, a desire for liberation. There must be, is there anything about me? Is there any place where there is freedom from this instability? Is there anything that is whole about me where I can relax, that I don't have to worry about it being subject to change? That's the mumukshutvam. Then there's this shamadhi shukha in between. These are the mental qualities of a seeker, of an adhikari, for this vision. Shama means gaining that ability to let thoughts go, so that the mind doesn't grab you. Dhamma is the ability not to act out when the mind does grab you. Shama, Dhamma. Then this is one. Upadati. Upadati is what is that quality that allows me to stick with something for a good period of time instead of being a dilettante. So now, say I have recognized I want to gain this knowledge. Do I have upadati? Do I have the ability to stick with something for the amount of time necessary for me to gain that knowledge? Or am I a dilettante? I'll study this for a while, but then I'll study this, then I'll study this, then I'll study this. This is one of the things that I'm studying, right? And that's part of what this is addressing. I mean, every person, at least in this society, everybody has to work. Everybody has to, they have to earn a living. You have so many responsibilities that you have to do. But what is primary? What is your focus? Is your focus split? You know, do you study Kavya, and do you study Tarka, and you study this, and you study that, and you study Vedanta also? You know, is it one of the things? You know? And so then your focus is continually divided. And then you become distracted from what you're meant to be seeing here. So that's the upadati. Are you able to stick with something to completion? And with a knowledge like this, you have to be able to do that. This knowledge isn't like having an experience and then boom, I have an experience and now I'm enlightened because I've had this experience and so now I should go teach everybody. What are you going to teach them? I'm enlightened now. I have had this experience. So is that what you're going to teach them? I'm enlightened. I've had this experience. You know? So sit with me and you will have the experience too. It's not, you know, that's not Vedanta. Vedanta is, the Upanishad means there's a vision, there's a knowledge that you have to gain. And knowledge takes place in time. It doesn't take place like that. It's something, it's understanding. And so that vision is, I mean, I remember so when I was in India with Swamiji in the 70s, Swamiji would give this class, you know, and we'd all be there in the class. And then after the class, I mean, I would be, you know, just following right behind him down to the satsang so that I could ask questions about the things I didn't understand in the class. And that didn't happen just once.
Every day.
Yeah. That went on for a long, long time. And listening for a long, long, long time. Because I would understand, but then what about this? Then what about this? Then what about this? And then I would listen again and I would understand what I had understood before, but in a totally different way, more interrelated, more interconnected. And then that goes on and on and on, that understanding, that seeing, until your mind finally reaches a point of satisfaction where you know, where you know yourself, but you also understand the mittattva of the creation. You know it. But that doesn't just happen overnight. That's not an enlightened experience. It's not about an enlightened experience. All of a sudden you see. The fact is that when this pramana, when the means of knowledge is taking place, you do see, and then you 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 see. And this seeing goes on for a long, long, long time. Because you see from this perspective and this perspective. You are a living, totally identified with the upadhi in this creation. And so there are a lot of things to understand, for the mind to understand, before it says, okay, forget it. Because the mind has to recognize that it is not the self. I am the self. It is not the self. The mind isn't going to just give up and lay over like that. You know? Because it thinks it will die. It's so relieved when it finally does lay over. Because what has happened to it is nothing. It never was the self. The mind never was the self. Even when it thought it was the self, that was its own, that it was identified, it never was. And so what happens to it when it finds out that I, in fact, am its changeless being? That I am its truth, but I am changeless. When it's there, I am there. When it's not there, I am there. It's relieved. I am free. I recognize I am free. It's a huge relief. But there's a lot of teaching that goes on to make for the mind, because the mind is the one that has to say, okay. I see it. It's the mind itself that has to surrender. Surrender is knowledge. There's no surrender without knowledge. And so there's a tremendous amount of teaching, a tremendous amount of clarity that has to take place in order for that, in order for that to happen. So here, what he's saying is, if you spend all of your time without that upadati, you know that upadati is not there, and so you've spread yourself and your commitments thin, then your mind is not going to be able to sit with this, to be able to understand it. Does that make sense? You can't pull it back. You can't pull your mind back because what you're committed to is pulling your mind out. See the difference? Like I can pull, say if this is your commitment, then in reference to your situation, in reference to your job, in reference to what you do, you can pull your mind back because of your knowledge, because that's what you're doing. This is all sadhana. But when that is your commitment, say that becomes your primary commitment, whatever it is, agricultural, tarka, whatever they're talking about, trade, then that pulls your mind out. That's your commitment. And then when that's your commitment, what about your knowledge? Well, that's shelved until a later time. So that's the idea. Let's do this next verse because it's all related here. So now you get something that does work just fine, no problem. Anusandhita, for the one who's contemplating, for meditating, doing nididhyasana, working on this viparita bhava. Okay. Here, bhojanadel, in such acts as eating, etc., eating, sleeping, bathing, taking care of the daily things that you have to take care of, parvartitum shakyate, he says, one is able to pursue, to engage in these things. Just the regular day-to-day things that you have to do as a human being. You have to eat. You have to sleep. You have to take a bath. You have to go shopping. There's all kinds of things that you have to do to take care of your daily life. He says, all of those things, atyanta vikshepa abhavat, those things don't cause much vikshepa, much distraction. Atyanta vikshepa means a lot of distraction. Atyanta vikshepa abhavat, this complete distraction is not there. Because these are just part, it's like breathing. You have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to go shopping, you have to take care of your house, all of these type of things. But these things are not a problem. He says, why? He says, ashu punaf smritehe. Because you remember again quickly. You remember again quickly. Right? Like you can be washing the dishes and involved in cleaning the kitchen, but this is not a big commitment, right? When the dishes are over, even while you're doing the dishes, this is not where your heart is not there, right? So you can do the dishes and still be enjoying your knowledge. You can take a shower and enjoy your knowledge. You can clean your house and enjoy your knowledge. You can do all of these things, these day-to-days that you have to do. Without those things do not become a big distraction for you, as opposed to starting a big business or taking on another discipline of another shastra. That's the idea. But these things, these day-to-day things like eating, sleeping, drinking, etc., these are not a problem because you quickly remember, you quickly get yourself back. Okay? Let's do the next one. It's all part of one thing. Tattva vismriti matrana tattva vismriti matran anartakim tu viparyayat anartakim tu viparyayat viparyetum nakalasti viparyetum nakalasti jatiti smaratak kuchit jatiti smaratak kuchit tattva vismriti matrat na anartha kintu viparyayat viparyetum nikalaha asti jatiti smarataha kuchit. I said something. Says, you know, just forgetting yourself, there's no anartha, there's no hurt in you, nothing happens. You're not, just like, if, say you're engaged, you're washing the dishes, or you're reading a book, or you're doing that, and you're not thinking, oh, I'm Brahman, I'm Brahman, I'm Brahman, the world is mitya, the world is mitya, the world is mitya, I'm Brahman, Brahman. Instead, you're enjoying your novel that you're reading. Or you're enjoying the food that you're eating. You're not remembering, not walking around remembering, I am Brahman, I'm Brahman, I'm Brahman. So you don't have to walk around remembering all the time. There's no problem in that, okay? That's not the problem. So he says, tattva vismriti, forgetting this, the tattva, in your mind, as a vritti, forgetting that, that matra, from only, from merely forgetting it, means your mind's not thinking about it, na anartha, there's no hurt, there's no problem, no calamity there. Rather, but, on the other, akin to, the anartaha viparyayat is from the misidentification. Right? It's, if I'm just forgetting myself, because I'm engaged in this or engaged in that, and not, my mind isn't thinking about it. Okay? No problem. The problem comes when I go that step further to identification with the body, mind, sense organs, with the world as real. The world, the jagat satyam, the world becomes real, and I become this body, mind, sense organs. That's the viparita bhavana. That's where the problem is. It's not about that I have to walk around repeating to myself all of the time who I am. The problem is when there's a self-forgetfulness that causes the misidentification. It's when that misidentification comes, then we get ourselves into problems. So he says, now, in reference to eating and taking a bath and drinking and keeping your house clean and going shopping, this kind of thing, he says, viparyetum nakalaha asti. He says, there isn't any time in these things for this misidentification because there's not a long-term commitment there. You're doing this and you're doing that. There's no time for you to get involved in this type of misidentification. Jatiti smarataha kuchit. He says, because of remembering immediately, right, because you quickly remember, anywhere that you are, which it means anywhere that you are, you're doing these things, it's taking care of your daily life, the things that have to be done. But there's no time. Your knowledge is coming back to you all of the time because there's nothing pulling you out into some other realm of reality, you know. Like getting involved in a business where the pull-up is what is primary to you, or getting involved in another field of study where gaining mastery in that is primary to you. One thing that just I wanted to mention this, I probably mentioned this before, but you know, Swamiji, he has such a beautiful voice for singing, and such a naturally gifted in music. And his teachers, when he was just starting to study Vedanta, is some teachers, musicians, would say to him, you really should study music. Come and we'll teach you music. You should really study music. You're very, very gifted. He was. He's still, to this day, he's tremendously gifted in music. He can write songs. He just has a natural rhythm. He has the whole thing there, plus the beautiful voice and perfect pitch. And he also loves music. So at one point, as he was a student, he was thinking, I think I would like to study music. Of course, music is a huge study. You know, it's at least 12 years, since it's any discipline, 12 years of real commitment. He was thinking, you know, I really would like to study music. I love music. And he started kind of thinking about it. And then all of a sudden, one day, he didn't get very far with this, but he said to himself, he said, no. No. I don't want to distract myself into that. And he made that, so he made a sankalpa. He said, no, I don't want to distract myself into that. Let me gain this knowledge. So he said no, he pushed it away. He's very glad he did that. He said it's the right thing to do. This is what Vidyaranya is talking here. So you have to understand the spirit of what he's saying. You're trying to gain this knowledge, and don't sidetrack yourself in terms of your commitment to something else so that you spread yourself thin. Gain this knowledge. You have to understand that in spirit, we all have to live in this world. You know, it's not like we can, we're not in India, where you can go and just live in an ashram. In fact, or just go up to the Himalayas, to just go up to the Himalayas and sit somewhere. Like Swamiji did. It's such a wonderful thing, you know. He decided to take sannyasa. At that time, you can't even do that now. But at that time, he went up to the Himalayas and he squatted. He just found a nice plot of land in Rishikesh on the banks of the Ganga, and he sat there, and that was his, he just marked out his territory, and that was his place. And then he built a little straw hut there. And some devotees that had been learning, taking classes from him when he was still a brahmachari, found out where he was and they came to study with him. People started coming to study with him, and then they helped build this little kutir. He started for a long time, he had just this one little kutir. That's all. You know, and he went and ate at one of the shalas where they served the food, and then after a while he stopped doing that also. And he just sat there, see what would happen. And so-and-so would bring some food, another sadhu would bring some food. He did that. It was very amazing, very beautiful to have that in your culture where you can do something like that. Where Rishikesh, that was the land for the sadhus. Rishikesh and north. Go to Rishikesh and north and then you just find a little plot and that's yours. You just, you're a sannyasi, you take that. So that's what he did. And then when he started, much later on when he started the three-year courses, the idea for that was, let students come and just sit someplace and then get out. But you sit somewhere 3 years just so that you can sit and study and not have all of these distractions. You know? That was his vision with that. But now for us, for most of us, at other times he said, having done this several courses, he's also said, in some ways he thinks it's much better for students to just live in their life and come to class and then go home. You know? Because you don't become like, he told one person, you don't become like a domesticated cat, you know, where you just, everything's kind of taken care of and then you have to deal with all of these other people. You still have your own center. That's also very powerful. So you have to understand what Vidyaranya is saying in the spirit of our culture. And the idea really is to have that karma yoga buddhi where your jnana is primary. That is what you're doing. You know? And you can't make it like that for yourself anyway. Either it's like that or it isn't. You know, but what I mean by in terms of attitude, what is primary for you in terms of your attitude? If that karma yoga buddhi is there, in terms of attitude, then what you're doing, your job and your day-to-day, everything that you're doing is your sadhana. Because what is primary then is how you are handling that situation in light of your own antakarana shuddhi, in light of your own knowledge. So we have to read it like that. You know. Okay, we have to stop. This goes on for several more verses. But anyway, it's useful. It's useful to understand what he's trying to say. Just take a minute. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
When you say having your own center and coming to class, what would be...
having your own center?
Yeah, if you're not in an ashram, so you're living in your own life and like that's your center, and then coming to class, what would a life like that ideally be like in order to stay focused on Vedanta? Like a meditation practice or study, or I'm trying to find out for myself, you know, how to get grounded here and stay planted in Vedanta, having a center, having a place.
Center, I meant yourself being centered. Right?
Oh,
that's how I was meaning.
Oh, because you said Swamiji was saying it can be better not to be in an ashram, but to have your own.
Oh, but what I meant is to, like, to have your own center. I didn't mean like a center.
Uh-huh.
But like have your own home, have your own place, have your own kind of friends, your own life.
Yeah,
and
that's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
Center.
Okay.
But what about that would ideally would allow growth in Vedanta? Because I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, one thing. What Vidyaranya is saying, what's kind of interesting about Vidyaranya, I think I've heard Swamiji talk like this also, he deals with things in a little, in a way that we sometimes, I myself don't even think in quite the way that he thinks. He thinks a little differently. Mm-hmm. But the good thing about him is he deals with these topics and kind of expands on topics that they're not just usually not talked mm-hmm. about. They're not dealt with. And I remember the first time I heard this Chapter 7, when Swamiji was teaching, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, he's talking about this? He's talking about this? I was really surprised at the type of subject matters he gets into and kind of dilates. But anyway, in reference to this, what he's saying in terms of trying to remove the viparita bhavana and have a do that nitta dhyasana, how to do it, there's many, many different ways, and it depends on what suits you. But what is it that would suit you? Like, for some people, it's having a lot of satsang. It's making sure that you go to enough classes so that your mind is... You know how the classes clear out your mind. You can get so engaged in samsara, then you come to class and everything gets cleared out and you... It's like brushing your teeth or something. You can taking a shower.
Rebooting the computer.
Start over.
So,
listening to tapes or reading or study or contemplative practice or, you know, satsang or engaging in discussion with other people who, you know, other gurubhais. All of these things so that you have that your own life has that for its center, whatever that takes for you to do that, and in whatever style you do that. I think people are very different in how they do that, you know. Because say you're in the world of samsara, where you're one, and then there's everyone else, like this. You know, there's just you with your knowledge, and then you're stuck there, kind of dropped in the middle of samsara, and there you are, you know. So then you want to have some satsang. You want to have a community of people. That's why satsang's so important, you know. You want to have a teaching available to you, and if there's not a live teacher, then to have some, you know, some tapes or CDs or something, be able to go to camps, to be able to do something that makes sure to keep your mind clear, keep the clarity there, until you are the clarity. If we're talking about, you know, I use the example in the Gita, I think I talked about this last week, there's a big, say you have a huge, huge bonfire, And that bonfire needs to be consumed by fire. Now it's just a huge structure. And you start by lighting a corner of it. Well, that corner needs to be protected until the fire catches. And so when you first come to this knowledge, you know, and for some time, your mind needs some protection from the samsara. And so that's where the satsang, you know, shravana manana nididhyasana teaching, and then reading itihasas or things that bring your mind, keep your mind in this knowledge, is very, very necessary, actually. I also use an example of, you know, a little tree that's just starting to grow. I've put a little kind of a wire fence around the tree so the deer won't come and the animals won't come and just eat it. Right? 'Cause it's weak. But eventually that will grow into a huge tree and it'll just overpower the protection itself. It doesn't need any protection. And so until your mind feels you're comfortable with your knowledge and it enjoys that shanti and that your own being, the be who you are, is not something that the mind seems to lose, you know, to lose that self-recognition. Until then, you protect yourself with these things. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And you decide what it is, the way that you want to do it. You know, like how I might do that might be very different from how you would do that. Because it's different personalities, different situation. You know? But satsang in class, as a student, and then satsang in class as a teacher. That's what I recommend. Satsang in class, you come to satsang, you go to class, so you have community, and you have this vision, you know, being wielded, you know, so that you have both community and knowledge taking place. And so you do that, and then you teach. Teaching, you shouldn't look at teaching as a problem. Sometimes people have a problem with teaching when they think of teaching because they think that you have to be a guru, and then you'll have your own notions about what that means, or that you have to impress people, or you have to be somebody special. And you don't have to be anybody special. You just have to be yourself, and you have to be able to, if you know something, then that what you know, then you can teach that. To say, even say with something simple, say it like something like Sanskrit. Say you know the alphabet, and your friend doesn't. That's all you know is the alphabet. Your friend doesn't know the alphabet. Or you're not a Sanskrit pundit. Is it all right for you to teach your friend the alphabet? Why shouldn't you? But what if you feel inside that to teach your friend the Sanskrit alphabet, you have to be a Sanskrit pundit? And you want to teach the alphabet, so you pretend like you're a pundit. That's a huge problem. That's a huge, huge problem. But if you just want to teach the alphabet, so your friend can learn the alphabet, then you say, well, I've learned the alphabet. That's how much I know. I can teach you that. And then we can go on together. Say with knowledge, it's good for you to be able to explain to another person what you know. You don't have to say, I'm a great Mahatma, I'm a great guru, and I have awakened, so let me teach you. You don't have to be awakened. You don't have to ever even use that word. It's very creepy, isn't it? Why can't, if you've understood something that's meaningful to you, why can't you tell somebody who wants to know that? Why can't you explain it to somebody? There's no reason. And that's what, the more you can explain, that's why in this chapter 7, I think it's verse 122 or something, where he says, what are the three things he says about it? You know, tat katanam, think tat chintanam, tat prabodhanam. You're thinking about it, chintanam. He talks about what is really the sadhana. You're thinking about it, you're contemplating on it, you're talking about it in satsang, katanam, sharing it. And anyata tat prabodhanam, something like that. So you are teaching each other. You teach each other. What is wrong with that? It's only because we have these some notions. And that, if you have those notions, that can be very damaging, because then you think you have to be somebody special. And then you have to live up to this thing. That's really awful. You have to live up to something that you're not. You don't have to live up to anything. I mean, you should be a responsible person, that's all. You know. You have to live up to your own sense of dharma. You do have to live up to something, but what is it? It's living up to your own sense of own dharma. What is dharma? And then that's all very, very helpful for gaining your own clarity. You know, it's really a wonderful thing. So I don't want people to shy away from that because of some of the abuses that can go on, kind of this potpourri, spiritual potpourri we have in, you know, and especially in California. That's kind of spiritual potpourri and makes it, you feel shy, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of logics that are very difficult to come forward with just people's basic thinking. What was the first one you said, that there should be, everything should be okay, and that one thing isn't correct and one thing isn't correct, like there's a one truth, not many truths.
Oh, I see,
yeah. One is true or the other is true, but both can't be true, whereas people like to think that anything, any opinion can be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, these kind of things are really hard to deal with in terms of talking to people.
Yeah, but then there's that other, see, things get complicated and we start talking about it. This is a complication also is, as Swamiji has said it before, Vedanta is not table talk. In other words, it's not just light conversation, and it's not meant to be something where you're telling this to somebody who doesn't want to know, you know? It's not an argument. I don't get involved in anything like that. I don't want to debate Vedanta. I don't want to be on a panel of Advaitins, an Advaita panel. Yeah, a panel of the non-dual teachers. Or a panel of the... They have these panels. I've been asked on a few occasions to be on a panel. There's this teacher and this teacher and this teacher and this teacher and of different spiritual disciplines, all different things to say. And that isn't for me. That's not for me. And I don't. Swamiji will do that kind of stuff, actually. If they ask him to go. He'll sit on the panel.
Bring them on.
I don't know quite what I'm trying to tell you, but I don't want to talk in that way with Vedanta, about Vedanta. Vedanta is really meant to be, it's a teacher-student relationship. And the student can have all kinds of doubts and all kinds of problems, all kinds of questions. That's fine. There's no limit to it, actually. There's no limit to the questioning and wanting to know and the doubts and all of that. That's all within the purview of Vedanta. That's supposed to be there because it gives... That's what really brings about the nishta, you know? But it's not an argument. It's not an argument. You know, it's a teaching. It's a learning. So you want to a student should be somebody to make for a student. To be a student, they have to have a certain amount of shraddha. That means that for whatever Ishwara Anugraha, whatever grace of the Lord, something tells you, I want to learn this. Because right? you don't know. You don't know what it is until you learn it. But something rings true, so you want to learn it. There's something tells you inside, I want to learn this. And the teacher that you're learning from, this teacher is okay. I can learn from this teacher. Because that's a problem too. You can say, I want to learn this, but not from her. Or I want to learn this, but not from that person, because our personalities don't work. It just doesn't work. I can't listen to that person. But I want to learn this knowledge. So that's, there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm saying for knowledge, for this knowledge to really work, you have to say, okay, this teacher is okay for me. She knows what she's talking about, or he knows what he's talking about. And this is what I want to learn. That allows the mind to be available, right? To learn. And then that doesn't say anything about, well, I should just take it all on faith. That has nothing to do with it. Shraddha is not taking on faith. Shraddha is just the openness of the mind, the willingness of the mind to learn so that it can understand. There's nothing, it's, Swamiji's called it sometimes faith pending understanding. Why he even uses this word? It's just, all it means is that my mind is willing to listen so that I can understand. That itself is a huge thing. For the mind to say, yes, okay, I'm willing to listen to this, I want to listen to this. Mm-hmm. That's not an ordinary thing for any subject matter. But there's a commitment that's involved in that. Something inside says, okay, I want to learn this. That's what Shraddha. And it allows the mind, you know, to expose itself to that teaching, to understand it. There's a whole thing in the, what the Upanishad has to say, it has only to do with knowledge. Because yourself is already free. It only is about knowledge. Seeing. And knowledge takes place through words. Because our sense organs, you know, which are, give us experience of the world, give us experience of Maya. They don't give us experience of the Satyam Nitya, right, of the whole. So words have to point out that reality to us. That means my mind has to be available to sit, to listen, to be patient. Words only take place one at a time, sentence by sentence by sentence.
Carol, given that many people that have been involved in spiritual things, most of them are Buddhists, so I don't think a certain amount of arguments can be avoided because they have certain notions that have to be refuted.
Well, yeah, but say if one of my students, just speaking first personally, one of my students was a Buddhist and now wanted to learn Vedanta. And so we'd bring in a lot of Buddhist questions. But they're studying, right, with me. And so I'm happy to answer all of those questions. I don't have any problem with that at all. But it's their questions, and they're studying Vedanta with me. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to go and sit on a panel with a Buddhist and a Vedanta and a shaman and all of these people, and then we... I mean, some people can do that. That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah,
I'm not personally drawn to that. And I don't really think that the pramana itself is not really going to function in that way. On the other hand, you know, when I think of somebody like Swamiji who will sit, go and sit in these things, and sometimes he'll just kind of shake his head because they're going to be strange, even in India. But he'll sit there, and then when it's his turn to talk, and he's got 15 or 20 minutes, and he talks, he unfolds something very, very meaningful. And then what he's unfolding could be, you know, a really important for somebody to have heard that, you know. Because in the last several years I haven't done any of this, but when I was in India and Swamiji would go to some of these things they'd have in India, we'd all go, you know, and sit through the whole thing. And sometimes I just kind of get, wow, this is wild. This is really crazy. But then he would talk, and it would be so powerful and so good, you know, so meaningful. At least that was how I felt about it. And I thought, well, this is a good thing. Because amidst all of that kind of stuff, there was somebody that was speaking with such clarity. That was my experience, and I thought that has a value.
I can't remember where that was, but I think there's an article, or rather a transcript, of him addressing a panel that was for freedom of religion or something like that.
Oh, yeah, he was very much very much a part of all of that. And what that was about, that was at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. Trying to stop the rampant conversion in India by the Muslims and the Christians to try to come to to bring all of these different religions into an agreement where they would acknowledge the right for other religions to exist. See what I mean? Yeah. And so they actually wrote a whole document, and they did a lot of work on this. And the Jews and Swamiji, the Hindus, kind of got together because they're not converting religions. And so actually Swamiji went to Israel and had some meeting with some of the rabbis who hadn't really realized that the Hindus, and they don't only believed in one God, they had a very deep conversation actually and kind of formed a, what do you call it, like a they coalition a little bit. And to help to strengthen, the Buddhists also are not converting. They're not a converting religion. And so to get the Christians and the Muslims to sign a document that would agree to the validity of other religions other than their own.
Did they do it? I don't think they did it.
They won't do that.
The Muslims, when the Christians also had a real hard time. Because
it's a cornerstone.
Yeah. But that was the work. So they did make some headway. Not as far as you want. To see if you believe in the God in the form of Ishwara, right, then there are just countless ways to worship the Lord. And all these different cultures, all of these different religions can worship the Lord in their own way. But then the problem is these different religions should allow all of these manifest ways of worship. You know, in India, they don't have a problem within the Hindu community. There's so many different ways, so many different Ishtadevatas, so many different rituals, so many different ways of worshiping Ishwara. So many different forms, countless. But then when you bring in religions from other religions, like particularly the Muslims and the Christians, they have a whole different view of it. And the Indians, Hindus, didn't understand that. When all the Muslims and Christians came, they welcomed them. They welcomed them, you know, because they worship the Lord like this, and they worship the Lord like this, it's fine. They did not understand that the Christians and the Muslims didn't feel that way about them. That what they felt was, we worship the Lord in this way, and so should you. Right? And so then there's been a huge problem in India because of that. And they're very late. The Hindus are very late in coming to consciousness around this. And so what has happened is a huge amount of India has been converted either to Muslim or Christian. Now, some states that's primarily Christian, some whole states primarily Christian, primarily Muslim. You can look it up on the internet and see that it's very, and see, it's a tragedy in a sense. I mean, Ishwara has to come in and do something. It's a tragedy because if you convert somebody into another religion, like say you take a Hindu and make them into a Christian, then now, whatever that person that was holding the dharmi, I was talking about this last week too, the dharmi that's holding the dharma is now not holding it anymore. And so now imagine when the majority of a whole state is no longer holding that culture. That culture is not there. Christians have, in Hong Kong and some different countries throughout the world, totally eradicated other religions. They're gone. They're dead. They're over. And Swamiji just really does not want that to happen in India. Or I think Bhagawan doesn't want it to have it happen, so he kind of implanted that seed in Swamiji and other people to try to save India. from the total destruction of this Vedic culture.
Carol, 50% of the state is Muslim, and a large percent is Christian.
Yeah.
And Hindus, I was there living with villagers, and there's so much shame around their culture and embarrassment, you know, that their culture has been lost. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's awful. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
We'll see. We have to pray. Things get so far gone, only Bhagavan can help. And our consciousness also, you know, consciousness around this, I think, can help too. It says in the Shastra itself that the knowledge will never be lost as long as the creation is, throughout the entire manifestation of the creation. Knowledge will always, that sampradaya will always maintain itself. It just might not be in the majority. Little pockets here and there, you know.
Was there any outlying questions?
Hi Jagadish, I'm just looking at you. No questions.
So Carol, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
This, you know, you were saying that.
Hi Kiki.
It's my eternal question, which someday I hope won't be eternal anymore. This seeing the satyam and the nitya.
Yeah.
You know? So that you see that in terms of, because I was transcribing something about this too. In Kwambatur, when you're talking to Swamiji.
Mm.
So you see that as a vritti, right? Because like the system pervades the vritti, right? So,
yeah.
And the consciousness too. So that.
Well, the satyam is the consciousness.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
okay.
But when he was discussing it, and you were discussing it with him, you were talking about chit and sat.
Yeah.
Kind of little.
Yeah.
Kind of a little bit.
Well, Swamiji was talking about how, if I'm thinking of the one, that Swamiji was talking about how important recognizing Sat is.
Yes.
And once you know that Sat is Chit, as you go do the Drikdrisha Viveka, the seer seeing, you come to the recognition that the being, the very existence that you are, is consciousness, and consciousness is existence, that the two can't be separate. Okay, so then, being is consciousness. But here, the rug isn't consciousness.
It's conscious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we would say, the rug isn't conscious, this isn't conscious, this isn't conscious, I am conscious.
Mm.
Right? But then once you recognize that the consciousness that this body, mind, sense organs enjoys is the satyam, then you see, this is not conscious, but it is in consciousness.
Yeah.
But this exists, it is. I say it is. But see, if I say this is, but I also say this is known. The isness and the knownness of this are not objectifiable. I can't objectify existence. I can say, like, look at this stand. I can't say, look at this existence.
Yeah.
But then I say, this stand is. I'm attributing existence to it. But where is the existence located? It is only my being. It is only being itself. Which is I experience my existence as amness. That amness is consciousness. So either the upadhi reflects consciousness, like the body, mind, sense organs, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, reflects consciousness, and so it says, I am the conscious being, or the stand or the chair doesn't reflect consciousness, and so then it's viewed as inert. But actually, from the standpoint of myself as a jiva, this body is known, this chair is known. The difference between my mind is known, the chair is known, the stand is known. The difference between the three is that the mind, for instance, is the sukshma sharira, the subtle body. So it reflects consciousness. The chair doesn't have a subtle body, so it doesn't. So the mind is known, the chair is known, the stand is known. But the mind reflects consciousness and is known. The chair doesn't reflect consciousness and is known, right? And the stand doesn't reflect consciousness as in is known. But in reality, all three are equally known and all three are equally maya. So use an example. Say I hold a mirror up to the sun and a rock up to the sun. Both are inert. Both are jada, right? The mirror and the rock. But the mirror reflects the sun and the rock doesn't. So the mirror says, I am the sun. And the rock just sits quietly, right? But in truth, both of them are equally warmed by the sun, equally illumined by the sun, equally known by the sun, right? And neither one is the sun. So like that, this body, mind, sense organs is mitya. This is mitya, this is mitya. All of them are part of the maya upadi. None of them touch the satyam. All of them have the satyam, the same satchit for their being.
Yeah. Sorry.
So you have to, what you have to notice is that when I'm looking out at this room through my sense organs, there is nothing that's away from chit or sat. Right? Because everything is and everything is known. You have no experience that is not that. That is and is known is the common denominator of every experience, equally, without any difference at all. Isness consciousness is exactly the same in every single experience that you have, subtle or gross. No, it doesn't make any difference. The differences are only in reference to the upadis, the conditioning adjuncts. This upadi doesn't reflect consciousness. This mind does. The sense organs do. They're sattva. And since they reflect consciousness, they allow for that adhyasa, that superimposition, for that mind to say, I am the consciousness. Where the stand doesn't have a sukshma sharira, doesn't have a subtle body, so it's not making any mistake. It has the same satchit, this is satchit, this is satchit, this is satchit, this is satchit. All exact, there's nothing but satchit. Consciousness existence. That is the clay of the pot. That is the stuff that is here. The changeless stuff. You know? So that understanding this difference between something having a sukshma sharira, a subtle body, and something not, like here in the plants have a limited sukshma sharira and all of us have a subtle body. Everything else, unless there's some insects floating around, everything else doesn't have that. And so, although everything is equally sat, chit, existence, consciousness, only the things that have subtle bodies are going to be reflected, and therefore they're the only things that are going to have that sense of limited identity. Because the mind will say, I am the sat, chit. Means, this body is an existent, conscious entity, and this isn't.
When you said, you can't see the existence with your sense organs, you know?
Right.
You can't see the sat.
Not as an object, because the sense organs can only see form.
Right.
The ears can only hear sound.
But my understanding, and maybe it's wrong, my understanding is even with your sense organs, as you're, you know, seeing whatever and analyzing, you know, the mitya, it's still, while you're analyzing it, it is. And so that's, you know.
When you say it is... Mm. That isness is such.
Yes, I know, yeah. But what I'm wondering, in a sense, and maybe I'm wrong, because as you're analyzing it, you know, you are seeing it, sort of.
No.
Yeah.
You're seeing the name and form.
Yeah.
And that's what you're analyzing.
Right.
But the name and form is pervaded, has for its being such it.
Yeah.
That you're not seeing.
Yeah.
But it is... what we call swatha siddha, it's self-evident, and it is you. Right? So set the consciousness, which is existent, is its own experience. The whole universe could, in the Chandogya Upanishad, they could roll up the universe like a piece of leather. Imagine the whole universe is a piece of leather. You roll it up and toss it away, and what is left? Me. Such it. I am the very being. Right? And that being doesn't need to be seen because it's self-fulfilled. It doesn't need eyes for it to be known.
Yeah.
It's self self-evident, self-effulgent. And so now, when you're looking through your eyes, analyzing the mityatva of the creation, the sat-chit is always there as the self-evident reality that's pervasive to the analyzer and the analyzed. Right? You are the sat-chit is the sat-chit, which is the truth of the subject and of the object. But it's self-evident. That's why you feel like you're kind of seeing it, because you're not actually seeing it. It is its own experience that is happening simultaneously with the sense perception. Right? Like just right now, as you're looking out through you're experiencing this room through your sense organs, so you're getting the vision of this room, and at the same time, you're self-aware. Is a self-evident presence of your being, right? They're both happening at the same time. Your perception through the sense organs and the isness, the set-chit of your, which is your being. Both are known at the same time, right? But the sense organs aren't giving you the self-experience. But there's nothing away from the self-experience. So even when you're looking out, there's nothing in your perception that's away from the self-experience. Just think of it. If you have a thought or an imagination, your imagination takes place in subtle time and space. Say if I ask you to imagine a meadow. That's a three-dimensional imagination. It's not just flat. You know? You have a three-dimensional imagination, and you can be walking through the meadow in your imagination. But the entire three-dimensional imagination is pervaded by sat-chit, which is your being, right? There's no part of it that is away from the being of yourself.
So it's kind of like for this, so I kind of feel like, oh, I've recognized, it's either, I feel like either I've got the problem of Dhyanma Buddhi, which is very possible, or else it's just kind of like I have to, I guess I just have to get used to the fact of kind of just sitting with the vritti that, you know, that I do pervade it. You know?
Well, I think Dehatma Buddhi is the problem that has to be worked on.
Yeah.
Because the shock in this, the positive shock in the gain of this knowledge is that the being that you thought to be really one with this body, you know, that's what you that very being you recognize is Brahman, right? And that's a surprise because it's you. When you say I am the body, you don't have any doubt about that being you. I am the body. That's me. Now, the very I am that you're talking about as the body, that one that makes you you, that I am that makes you you, it is that one that is Brahman. And so what happens is, that which you've so convinced is the body that you don't even think about it, that has to be that you that is so intimately you, the one that you love, the one that you don't want to die, who cares about Brahman if I die, yeah. It's recognizing that one, that is the one that's Brahman. And then you recognize, then this body, mind, sense organs gets given over to Ishvara, and you recognize that this me is stable. So that's the type of nididhyasana.
But you know, the thing is, it's kind of like, it's me, but it's not the me that, it's not, it is the me that you always took as me, right? But it's not exactly the same me that you tend to think is me. In a certain way, because if it's the lamp, the books, that's me. But in other words, my being is the being of that.
Yeah.
That's not consistent with the way we normally think. Well, I guess the problem is our idea of me is so tied in with the idea of a limited me that's over here and the world's out there.
Well, what you have to realize is that this me that you take to be me never changes, never modifies, it's always the same. Right? And so if that's so, if you recognize that, it's always constant in every vritti, no matter what the body is doing, what the mind is thinking, what the emotions are there, it is absolutely constant as all the vrittis change and everything. then there's no way that that me can be those things. They're also objectifiable. And so that's how you do the viveka, to free this personal me from these things that it had been associated with, which in fact it never had been associated with at any time. But then you couldn't...
The body.
Yeah, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the moods, the emotions. They never never touched me at all.
Okay.
You know? And so you have to recognize, who is me? Is that me? Or are these things that are objectifiable and coming and going me? They're not at all. You never really... Even the Ajnani, the one who doesn't have knowledge, never really takes those things on one level to be me, the thoughts or anything. You couldn't, because even though you don't think about it, if the thoughts come and go, they leave. If they leave, they're gone. The emotions come and go, they're gone. I'm still here.
Right.
Right? So yeah. Who is still here?
No, but even... But the more problem is that to get to the point where you actually see that what we think of as the external world is me. That's it. Only exists because of me. My being is its being.
Yeah.
Only. You know, so then, as long as you do what you're thinking of is me, if you say that and you're thinking of me in the wrong way, it either doesn't make sense at all, or it becomes like solipsism or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why I think, you know, in a certain way, why probably the Buddhists start talking about not me or no self, you know, because people get so hung up with what they think that you have to somehow deconstruct the whole sense of what the me is, which is what the whole Dhritarishtra's viveka is supposed to do.
Either way,
if there's any remnant there, it seems like you still can't really see that.
But see, if there's a remnant
there,
the
external world is also.
That's right. If there's a remnant there, then that remnant hasn't been focused on in the light of this knowledge, because that remnant also has to go.
Right.
There can't be a remnant there.
Right.
The nature of yourself, the inviolate, non-objectifiable nature, free from time and space, being of yourself, has to be recognized as is. Otherwise, there's something within the upadis that you're hanging on to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just a slow...
See, this is what I don't understand. So I feel like I recognize myself from a changelessly present, wearable conscious being, separate from this body. And so that's the me, you know?
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't seem like it's the me of us. It's like the me of the body, mind, sense, organs. But it doesn't seem like it's the me of anything else.
Well, you know why, though?
I'd love to know why.
Well, for one thing, from the standpoint of this body, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body that you have indwelling this physical body, only pervades the physical body. It doesn't pervade the whole universe. If it pervaded the whole universe, then that would be your body, and of course I'm the universe, right? So what has to happen is that you have to recognize the sukshma sharira itself and the physical body are part and parcel of drishya, the seen world. They're part and parcel of Ishwara. That's why using the dream illustration can be so, so helpful, because you can see how the living beings, like in a dream world, are part and parcel of the dream. They're not separate from the dream. They're part of Ishwara. So you have to understand it in that way. And then if that Dhritarishtra Viveka has been complete, then this body, what's happening as you do the Dhritarishtra, this body is given over to Ishwara, because it's drishya, seen. Drishya means seen. It's given over to Ishwara. Sense organs are given over to the whole. The mind is given over. The ahankara, the I notion, is given over, because objectifiable. So then, in the end, you're just left with yourself, which you can't give, because it's not objectifiable. It's just self-effulgent. And so now, this body no longer belongs to the Atma. It belongs to Ishwara. Because nothing belongs to the Atma. See, the Atma is not contained. It's not a size. It's not like a pea in the body. You know, it's like the body a container and the Atma a little, you know, little pearl in there or something. The Atma, there is no time, there's no space, there's no dimension. In fact, when you do a meditation sometimes where you're just sitting with yourself, you can have your mind ask something like, okay, what size am I? Just like me, the conscious being. The word, it doesn't apply. What color am I? There's no color. How tall am I? These words have no meaning at all. Am I big? Am I small? No meaning. Because this type, all of these concepts exist in duality. Right? And so now I have to recognize the me that I am as me, this conscious being, is in total. I'm not just have partial self-experience. The self-evident conscious being that I am is full and complete. It's not as though, because some people get confused like this, if I have a mirror and I hold the mirror up to the sky, say there's a beautiful clear sky, I hold the mirror up to the sky. The mirror is reflecting the sky, but only part of the sky, right? There's a huge sky. The mirror's only reflecting part of it. But here in this example, the sky is spatially huge. You know, it has dimension and distance, and the mirror is tiny. And so the mirror reflects the huge sky, but not all of it, just a little piece of it. So we can think our mind is just a little mind. You have a little mind, you have a little mind, and we're all just reflecting little pieces, recognizing little pieces of the self. But that isn't true at all. The mind is, the self is free of time, it's free from space. Right? And so like, say if you, just from yourself, you have an imagination, you have, so I ask you to imagine a huge, beautiful meadow with mountains. That huge dimensional space that I've just imagined projects, that Maya projection comes from a self that has no time and space. So it's not like yourself goes shoo and becomes big like with the meadow and the mountains and then becomes small if I ask you to look at a small space. There's no time or space involved. You are absolutely whole and complete. The self experience is not mitigated by the mind. The mind is no way responsible for your self-experience of consciousness. If consciousness experience is because of consciousness, it's its own experience, it's self-evident. So your me, the me that makes the I am, those words are referring to something which is self-shining, self-evident, that is not dependent on the body, mind, sensors. You get rid of them and that's me is still there. So that's what needs to be meditated on.
But who is it that says I am?
That's the mind. That's a thought. But just like if I say if I, my mind now, using my sense organs, I see this lamp and I say this is a lamp. So I'm labeling this, okay? Now, here the mind says, I am consciousness. Now, so for Jnani, say the mind has knowledge. Those words, I am consciousness, those words are referring to consciousness. But the conscious being, me, I am consciousness, is illumining the mind that is saying, I am consciousness. Right? But the mind is labeling that self. So there's consciousness, which, okay, look like this. If I say, this is a lamp, what if I don't say, this is a lamp? Lamp doesn't care, right? The lamp is not dependent on my saying this is a lamp. Consciousness is not dependent on the mind saying I am consciousness or this is consciousness. That's a label. Even the mind says the words I am. It's referring to me, the conscious existent being. It says I am. Okay, now the mind has labeled me. Now it doesn't say I am. I'm still there. I don't care. I don't need the mind to say I am in order for me to be. And in fact, you don't walk around saying I am, I am, I am, I am. The amness which you are is self-evident and changeless. It's its own light. Consciousness is its own experience. It doesn't require anything for it to be experienced. So now with that understanding, notice that all of the thoughts in your mind, all of the thoughts, they are illumined. They are known, 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 known. The thoughts keep going. They enjoy consciousness while they're there. They go, the consciousness is still there. Right? So that this is the mind is mitya. In other words, the consciousness it enjoys, and for it to be known, for it to exist, such it. You know, that is the Atma, that's the self. And when the mind is there, it has that for its being. If your imagination is there, it has that for its being. Imagination goes away, I still am. But you need a mind to be saying, I still am. But whether I have the mind saying, I still am or not, I still am. Right? See what I mean? Yeah.
Doesn't change to now.
The Atman, the self, the limitless self that you are, doesn't need to know. But the mind is the one that needs to know, because the mind is the one that is suffering from the self-ignorance. So this mind takes itself to be limited and subject to death, and so is having so much suffering in the world, right? The individual suffers. Individual suffers because of its misconception. Like the mind says, I am this body and I'm going to die. I am a conscious being who is this body, and this body is going to die, therefore I'm going to die. You know? Or I am my mind. And then whatever the thoughts are in my mind or emotions, if my mind is happy, I'm happy. If my mind is sad, I'm sad. Because there's no viveka, there's no discrimination between my being and the mind. And so the mind suffers because of that. It's identified itself with something which is free and changeless. And that's where the ignorance is, and that's where the viveka, the discrimination, has to come in. And that's what the teaching methodology does, is take you step by step.
But what is the mind except for some neurons that cross synapses? What the chemical process?
Well, you know, that's getting kind of into a different...
Okay.
So
let me rephrase
okay.
The question. The mind is something that appears in consciousness.
Okay.
That changes, but never is the same.
Right.
So what is it we're conditioning? What is it we're training? What is it we're educating?
Well, just like it's that mind that, whether you want to take it as the brain or the subtle body, I'll get into that later. So you just take it as the mind. With that mind, you can say it's just neurons and synapses, but that mind is capable of learning, right? You go to school, you learn, you perceive, you have memory. So the mind is an instrument that you use. Now, when this mental instrument, whether you break it down to synapses or whatever you want to do, it doesn't matter. Still, in the world, you know that the mind is something that you use to learn, okay? Now, say this mind has certain notions, because the mind is capable of ignorance too. That's why we can study and gain knowledge and remove ignorance. The mind has certain notions. These notions that it has, born of ignorance, can cause a lot of pain. Even though they're ignorant, they're notions. But when you gain knowledge to remove those ignorant notions, the pain that the ignorant notion has caused is removed.
Yeah. Doesn't care.
No, it doesn't. But the one who is suffering is the one that wants to remove the pain. In other words, can you, like for instance, I can say, you know, this body is really not me. It's physical body, belongs to the creation, it's not me. And then say I break my arm. I would rather not have the pain of that broken arm, I would immediately go and get a cast. I would have a doctor put a cast on it and let it heal so I didn't have to suffer that pain. I mean, I think most people would do that. If you're sick or suffering, your physical body is suffering, even though you know that it's not me, then you will do suffering to fix it. So your mind also. People go to therapy. They go to psychologists just to take care of pain and complexes in the mind, because they would rather not be with the suffering. Now, what is the biggest suffering, the fundamental suffering, is self-ignorance, of not even knowing who you are. And so that's causing just a blanket suffering that is pervasive to your life. And I would rather not be with that suffering. You have, as a human being, and as animals also, you go toward pleasure or sukha, peace, and you go away from fear, away from pain, away from suffering. Okay? And so this one that is caught in this world of transmigration, of birth and death, that one wants out. Because they want out because they take they're identified with this body, mind, sense organs. And so it's that one that needs to gain knowledge. The self and the knowledge, and why does knowledge help? Because the self in truth has never had any problem at all. But the mind thinks that it's limited, and that misappropriation of the self to itself causes a lot of pain. And so this unwinds that problem. We got three more later. Let's stop now.